Don Blue.
Tengo que decir que la CIA, durante la época de Allende, pasó fondos secretos a crear un instituto económico en Chile que adaptó estos programas de economía, de neoliberal, de Friedman Economics, los chicos de Chicago. Y cuando llegó los militares, ahí está este instituto con todas sus recomendaciones. Y como todos saben, los Chicago Boys y Milton Friedman mismo corrieron a Chile para usar los militares como un experimento en free market economics. Este es un debate grande todavía en Chile en este momento y está cambiando. Porque estos tipos de economía no sirven los intereses del pueblo chileno y muchos otros.
La Comisión Balek apunta alrededor de 40.000 asesinados, torturados, desaparecidos y exilados bajo la dictadura patrocinada por Washington. Pero la agrupación de familiares de detenidos y desaparecidos estima que el número de víctimas superó los 100.000. A eso hay que agregar el legado de Pinochet, que entre otras cosas incluye la ley antiterrorista que hasta nuestros días es usada para criminalizar indígenas mapuches y otros disidentes chilenos. En Los Ángeles, yo soy Fernando Velázquez.
La historia no se detiene ni con represión ni muerte. Son tus últimas palabras, compañero presidente.
En México, decenas de miles de integrantes de la Coordinadora Nacional de Trabajadores de la Educación, la CENTE, rodearon el miércoles la residencia oficial del presidente Enrique Peña Nieto.
Estamos rodeando totalmente los pinos por todos sus lados y hay alrededor de 70.000 trabajadores de la educación movilizados en la Ciudad de México. A nivel nacional son 500.000 maestros y 26 estados de toda la República Mexicana.
Los maestros demandan derogar la reforma educativa y piden un diálogo directo con el presidente. Lo que fue denominada la mega marcha de la resistencia y la desobediencia civil ocurrió un día después de que el presidente Peña Nieto promulgara las leyes secundarias de la reforma educativa. Gonzalo Martínez Villagrande es integrante de la Comisión Nacional Única de Negociación de la CENTE.
A pesar de la campaña mediática de linchamiento que han generado las televisoras oficiales de acá del país y nosotros hemos rebasado y hemos remontado ese linchamiento, hay mucha solidaridad. La gente llega al campamento de los maestros a dar víveres, a llevar los saludos, a invitarlos incluso a las casas a bañarse y hay una muestra grande de solidaridad de la ciudadanía del Distrito Federal.
El Sindicato Independiente Magisterial mantiene desde hace 3 semanas un plantón de 30.000 trabajadores en el Zócalo de la capital mexicana.
Llevamos 3 semanas plantadas, pero el paro indefinido se ha ido generando, tiene 3 semanas ahorita los compañeros de Oaxaca que no reiniciaron el ciclo junto con Michoacán, Chiapas y paros parciales en las 38 estados de la República, en las 38 secciones. O sea, ahorita hay una movilización grande en todo el país. Estados tradicionalmente pasivos como Quintana Roo, como Coahuila y Tamaulipas hoy se están movilizando en todo el país.
El Magisterio Independiente está fortaleciendo alianzas con otros sectores sociales ante la creciente inconformidad en México por las reformas educativa, laboral, energética y hacendaria.
Es el temor que tiene el gobierno mexicano de que efectivamente los trabajadores de la educación hemos manifestado una oposición categórica a todas las políticas neoliberales y obviamente el temor que existe de desbordar el ánimo de los maestros conjunto con las organizaciones y la población, pues los tiene en un estado de sitio. Incluso aquí los pinos están alrededor de 10.000 policías de la Policía Federal y de la Policía del Distrito Federal.
En Estados Unidos, el presidente Barack Obama y políticos en otras partes del país realizaron ceremonias y actos públicos para conmemorar el 12 aniversario de los ataques terroristas al Centro Mundial de Comercio en Nueva York, donde se reportó la muerte de cuando menos 3.000 personas. Una nueva encuesta de opinión patrocinada por el grupo Rethink 9/11 revela que casi la mitad de los norteamericanos no cree la historia oficial de que unos cuantos piratas aéreos árabes burlaron su sistema multimillonario nacional de inteligencia. Más de un centenar de esos incrédulos realizaron una protesta en la capital del país, en Washington D.C. Kevin Garrett es el vocero nacional del Comité de Acción Política Musulmán Americano.
We're here to memorialize all of the victims of the crimes of September 11th, 2001, and that would include not only the nearly 3,000 people murdered that day.
Él nos dijo que estaba en esa protesta para rendir homenaje a todas las víctimas del 11 de septiembre, no solo los que fueron asesinados por manos criminales en las Torres Gemelas y los ataques posteriores con Amtrak, sino los más de 2 millones en otros países muertos en guerras de agresión norteamericana en el nombre de la guerra contra el terrorismo. Garrett añade que si se toman en cuenta todas las personas a quienes se les ha negado su libertad con la guerra antiterrorista, definitivamente hay que hablar del pueblo estadounidense. La Constitución ha sido seriamente dañada, la Cuarta Enmienda destruida, asesinatos con aviones drones, ejecuciones extrajudiciales y la economía dañada con el gasto de billones de dólares en esas guerras sin sentido. El doctor Kevin Garrett dice que el cuestionamiento de la historia oficial no se limita a casi la mitad de los norteamericanos. El 89% de los alemanes piensa que el gobierno de Washington no está diciendo la verdad sobre lo que pasó en esa fecha. Además, como tres cuartas partes de los musulmanes del mundo no creen que los ataques fueron perpetrados por piratas aéreos árabes. No obstante la censura generalizada en los medios corporativos, la teoría oficial no recibe mucho respaldo. Kevin Garrett señala que hay miles de razones para no creer la historia oficial. Una de ellas es el desplome simétrico y vertical sobre sus mismos cimientos del rascacielos número 7 que cayó en Nueva York sin que ningún avión se estrellara contra su estructura.
Si
en realidad hubieran participado 19 piratas aéreos en los aviones secuestrados, dice, ¿cómo es que no han mostrado las fotos o videos de estos haciendo fila para entregar su equipaje, luego para abordar el avión, etcétera?
The only passenger list that exists that were given to the media have no Arab names on them.
Añade que la única lista de pasajeros ofrecida a los medios de comunicación por las autoridades no tenía nombres árabes y 10 de los supuestos participantes en los ataques aparecieron vivos en sus casas. Por su parte, el periodista Laurent Guyenot escribe en la Red Voltaire que existen suficientes elementos para creer que la verdad sobre lo ocurrido el 11 de septiembre de 2001 se parece más bien a lo que declarara el expresidente italiano Francesco Cossiga al diario Corriere della Sera. Cossiga dijo, nos quieren hacer creer de que Bin Laden confesó ser el autor del atentado del 11 de septiembre de 2001 sobre las Torres Gemelas de Nueva York, a pesar de que los servicios de inteligencia de Estados Unidos y europeos sabían muy bien que el desastroso ataque fue planeado y ejecutado por la CIA y el Mossad, con el fin de acusar a los países árabes de terrorismo y para poder atacar a Irak y Afganistán. El doctor Kevin Garrett concluye diciendo que no hay nada que temer, pues el terrorismo es una amenaza inferior a un rayo cayendo del cielo o ahogamientos en la tina de baño de la casa. Ya llegó la hora, dice, de acabar con esa guerra contra el terror y comenzar una nueva etapa en la historia. En Los Ángeles, yo soy Fernando Velázquez.
Hemos llegado al final de otra edición del Informativo Pacífica. A nombre del director del proyecto, Fernando Velázquez, se despide Norma Martínez.
Coming up next, Informativo Pacífica.
A continuación, Informativo Pacífica.
¡No te la pierdas!
But actually coming up next is Bathrop's Piers Broadsides, the Thursday show. Today is September 12th, 2013, and we are going live on the stream, and who knows, eventually, I think sooner than later, on the air. That's good news. Stay tuned for more good news, plus special guest Doug Loisel, former Homeless Services Center director, and also some commentary on the latest anti-homeless ordinances passed by the Santa Cruz City Council on Tuesday. Stay tuned.
Genocide, where is home? against the law to feed homeless. It's against the law to sleep in the park. It's against the law for you to see me. I live outside. I'm against the law. I'm a criminal. Cop, I wanna eat. Fuck you, mayor, I live here. Fuck you, law-abiding citizen, you pushed me here. Fuck you, voter, I will never disappear. All your systems will crash one day, and you will crawl to me.
And that was, three songs. Land by 15, Surf Song by Trailer Trash, UK, and Liberal San Francisco by Seth. So you are tuned to the stream of Free Radio Santa Cruz at freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norris. This is the September 12th edition of Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. You're live here, and I'm live there, or vice versa. If this is Thursday on your calendar, you can call in at 469-3119. I'm going to be having a special guest calling in very shortly, in about 4 minutes, Doug Loisel of, I guess he's in Los Angeles right now. But what I want to do is read some of what he's written. He's the former director of the what I call now the Homeless Lack of Services Center. And he's much further in a tolerant liberal and I think a sensible position than the current management there, as well as, of course, the political folks in Santa Cruz who've recently been passing anti-homeless laws, which I'll also be getting into later in the show. Let's listen to what he wrote recently, which I put out as an email for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom's blog, and you can also get on the Huff email list if you'd like and get those by sending an email. Go to the Huff website, huffsantacruz.org, huffsantacruz.org, where these shows are also archived. Everything's happening at the Huff website. And recently, Doug wrote the following: Monterey County, take a page from Santa Cruz County. And this is a relatively long essay, so I'm just going to read some of it, and Doug will be talking on the air shortly. In life, there's always a backstory. That lies beneath the public story. With homelessness, the backstory seems to be either forgotten or ignored in the service of finding a reason for our economic woes, public safety concerns, and increased crime. The portrayal of the homeless as the primary cause for economic decline has become popular in cities like Santa Cruz, and that is the sad public story. Santa Cruz has identified the homeless as its scapegoats, even though it's irresponsible and inaccurate to blame the homeless for community problems. There is no research that indicates a link between the homeless and increases in crime, decreases in public safety, or economic hardship. This perception is a local government and media fabrication. There is a mythological hope these problems would decline in a cause-and-effect fashion with a decline in the homeless population, and so the crusade to rid the community of homeless persons is collectively justified. The sad crusade led by the media, local government, small businesses, and law enforcement marches forward in a grossly expensive, ill-conceived, and poorly organized plan to decrease homelessness and thus fix Santa Cruz's tribulations. Or just to drive the homeless away, I might editorialize. Monterey County officials, that's the county to our south, are beginning to consider how to best manage the homeless in their community. The city of Santa Cruz, with its chronic and significantly higher homeless population, appears to be a place of unmanageable frustration with their ability to manage the homeless. The city of Santa Cruz, apparently believing they are replete of options, has initiated taking, I guess depleted of options is what he means, has initiated taking careless, punitive measures against the homeless. As the economy continues to meander along, Santa Cruz businesses pressure the city council to purge areas of commerce, such as retail stores, small businesses, restaurants, and coffee shops, of the, quote, scourge of the homeless. It seems the homeless are considered a nuisance and drive patrons away. Despite the fact there isn't any evidence that homeless folks negatively impact local economies, the pervasive belief persists that businesses are adversely affected. Recently, it seems this belief was reflected in the Salinas restaurant owner who nearly beat to death a homeless man who was spending too much time near his restaurant and received a 9-year prison sentence for this act of violence. I personally avoided using the pejorative term loitering. When a homeless person stays a while in a park, it's called loitering. When a family stays a while in a park, it's called a picnic. Unsure of whether to take a compassionate approach or a law enforcement no-sit, no-sleep, protect the asphalt and medians approach, Monterey County is currently contemplating what direction to take. In truth, we can't even pinpoint why people become homeless or why they stay homeless, let alone estimate their impact on local economies. The tendency is to move forward with spit and vinegar to address and eliminate the homeless scourge. The gung-ho approach often leads to disaster and occurs when public policy is dictated by passion and emotion rather than sound research. When this occurs, the potential for misguided decisions increases exponentially, often resulting in unanticipated human suffering In the absence of sound research, extremely careful consideration needs to be given when leaders chart the direction of community public policy. A study conducted by UC Berkeley regarding the homeless suggests, quote, no one believes there is a simple single cause. Explanations fall into two main categories. One puts primary emphasis on the debilitating personal attributes of many of the homeless, alcoholism, crack cocaine addiction, and personality disorders, and the changes in social policy toward these illnesses, rapidly rising rents, declining numbers of low rental units, and deceleration in federal housing programs, to put it mildly, are noted but are not thought to be central. The other emphasizes the economics of the low-rent housing market while acknowledging that many debilitating personal attributes of many of the homeless. Neither camp denies the importance of making more housing accessible to the poor. Befuddling. So the front story is that personal attributes and the high cost of housing are the primary causes of homelessness. The back story is much darker and painful. The life histories of homeless persons reveals common shared experiences, including violent victimization that contribute to their becoming homeless. A Toronto study of homeless persons found that 49% of women and 16% of men experienced childhood sexual abuse, compared with rates of 13% and 4% in the general population. Wow, I thought that women were, one out of every three women was likely to be raped during her lifetime, was what, so this sounds like a lower stat than I'd heard. High levels of family violence, lack of care, and sexual abuse are contributing factors. They're common in the histories of homeless persons as contributing factors. A history of family violence also predicted failure to exit homelessness. The quandary of the homeless, mental illness, high rent, drug addiction, and victimization as a child. These are the folks prohibited from laying down on sidewalks and medians, and this is the man that was nearly beat to death in Salinas for loitering. We are generous with ourselves when we perceive ourselves as an educated society. In times of panic, communities try to find someone or something to blame for their troubles, and the homeless are an easy target. I think it's important to mention the recession of 2008 wreaked havoc on business in both areas, with homeless persons and without homeless persons. The 2008 economic collapse, in hindsight, was clearly a result of the deregulation of the banking institutions, mass incarceration of nonviolent drug offenders, corporate greed, the war in Iraq, and the subprime mortgage scandal. All subsets of the Bush neocon experiment. These problems were a trickle-down result of the Bush mega-ignoramuses, and we are still trying to recover. It's easy to understand communities like Santa Cruz feeling disempowered and frightened, trying to understand why their businesses have failed would blame the homeless. Santa Cruz has sought to control the homeless population as a means to return their sense of control over their dim economic circumstances. The immediacy and visibility of the homeless population breeds contempt. It's a lot easier to target what's presently visible than an abstract and infinitely complex federal monetary system based on obfuscation and deception. Corporations spend a lot of money on public relations. In other words, it's hard for people to connect the financial anxiety they experience to derivatives, but it's easy to connect it to a dirty person sitting in front of a Starbucks asking for spare change. Studies show that indoor and outdoor substance abuse occurs at about the same rate, and for obvious reasons, outdoor substance users are disproportionately represented in the legal system. Thus, it's easy to focus on homeless substance use. And there's a lot more to that, but I think this is our man calling in. Let's see if it is. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hey, Robert. Doug.
Doug Loisel, or should I say Dr. Loisel?
Doug is fine, although Dr. feels good.
Uh-huh. Well, yeah. Doctor me up there, Doug, and let me know what's cooking. I've just been reading your story, some of it, that your essay you put out that's entitled Monterey County, Take a Page from Santa Cruz County. Don't you mean Flee in Horror from Santa Cruz County?
I don't know about that. And I was listening to it, and I was getting a little bored, so I thought I'd, you know, take the opportunity to call in.
Bored? Your rhetoric boring? Oh, please.
Yeah, no, I don't think I'm ready for the New Yorker.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I certainly like it when you kind of thrust home. It's what's really needed, of course, is to have. I was going to ask you about some of the allegations you make that there is no research that indicates a link between the homeless and increases in crime. Let's start with that. I of course agree with you ideologically, because I'm a big advocate of civil rights for homeless people, but I also want to be factually accurate with my newsman hat. Or my researcher hat. I haven't actually seen any studies that do document increases in crime and homelessness. But as you know, the I don't know if it's the Bible, but certainly one of the sources cited by the Santa Cruz Police Department is the Broken Windows articles that appeared in the Atlantic Monthly back in the 80s that blame homeless people as crime suggesters because they are like, quote, broken windows in a building where one is broken, more will soon be broken because it encourages people to believe that it's okay to break a window there. That is, a homeless person with a backpack and ragged clothing sitting next to a building is like a broken window. And I've never bought that, but have you seen any research either way on this that shows pro or con or anything around this subject?
Yes, I have. Homeless crime tends to be inter-homeless, right? Which means that homeless crimes tend to be crimes perpetrated against other homeless persons. Just going back to the what was the article in 1980s? The article
it was an
that
article in Atlantic Monthly and around the early 80s, and I don't have authors, but
you know, I think that using that article or canonizing that article as some sort of factual piece is irresponsible, because it was an essay, I'm sure, and clearly there would be no empirical validation to a statement like that. There's no empiricism, there's no research, there's no actual statistical analysis. Somebody's just postulating that, you know, some, you know, a theory that, you know, homelessness breeds crime, or, you know, if one homeless person does A, the next homeless person is going to do B, as if there's some sort of lemmings following each other. So, so homeless crime actually, from my research, is inter-homeless, which is within within the homeless population. Homeless persons have a tendency, from my observations, to not want to draw attention to themselves. So a homeless person is probably less likely than another person to perpetrate a violent crime on somebody other than in a homeless encampment, where territoriality is an issue, protection of property is an issue, exploitation of women sexually is an issue. So that's one set of homeless crimes that are perpetrated. The other set are just petty, petty theft. I suppose in Santa Cruz, if you panhandle, that's considered a crime. Sitting, you know, this no sit, no sleep laws, loitering, trespassing, shoplifting, those sorts of petty crimes. Are those called larceny? Those types of small
crimes? I'm not
crimes?
Sure. I'm not sure the difference between larceny and, I guess, burglary is when you break in, you know. And
right. So, of course, crime happens among all populations, but I have not seen anything that indicates that there's the media portrayal, from what I've observed regarding homeless crime, is that it's pandemic, that somehow it's this epidemic that has scourged the community. We're collapsing under the weight of, you know, homeless persons perpetrating nonstop crimes, victimizing folks, you know, costing, you know, millions of dollars, when really the true cost of homeless crime is the arrest and attempted conviction of persons committing these petty crimes. Prosecuting a person, I think you wrote an article, or there was an article on that you had put out on Huff, talking about the woman who was trying to find a place in her van, who was pulled over, who was arrested, booked, incarcerated, brought to trial. And that's where the true cost comes into these things. Homeless persons committing crimes in the community, you know, a crime of loitering too long at a 7-Eleven, being picked up, being given a ticket, having to show up to court, being given fines that they're never going to pay or unlikely to pay. That's where the true cost of all this comes in. One of the problematic crimes that happen in inter-homeless is the exploitation of women, and that homeless women tend to have a male that they have to attach to, because when the homeless are pushed to the outskirts of a community where there's less likely to have police protection, they have to be very cautious isn't the right word. They have to be very concerned about becoming victims of sexual violence. And so they tend to attach on to another male in exchange for sexual access to simply for protection. They may not be interested in the relationship. They may not be interested in the person, but in the interest of safety, they allow sexual access in exchange for protection. That's a huge problem when you push people out into areas like the Poganip, and into unpoliced areas, which is what the sleeping ban, the no sitting ban, effectively does.
Hmm. You're currently living in Los Angeles?
No, actually, I live in Carmel,
oh, wow.
California, and I work. I am the basically the program director of a methadone clinic in Salinas.
You're having needles everywhere with the needle exchange. We have that, of course, hysteria that gripped Santa Cruz about 6 months ago and resulted in the closing of the city's needle exchange program.
I spent about 8 hours researching to find out if anybody had really ever been infected with either hepatitis or HIV, stepping on a needle. And there was one possible, and we're talking about internationally, one possible infection, but they weren't really sure. There's really no indication that anybody has really stepped on a needle and gotten an infection. It seemed to me like it was non-existent, yet the media portrayal of the needles everywhere issue was that this is, again, an epidemic in our community. People are becoming infected every day. The hysteria surrounding the needle exchange issue is really outrageous. And it's just, from my research, inaccurate.
Has it impacted Salinas and Carmel at all?
The needle exchange program?
Well, the needle hysteria in terms of either impacting needle exchange programs or police enforcement of homeless people because they're perceived as being drug abusers, as they're being characterized here in Santa Cruz.
You know, from my visceral observations, just from reading your articles, which you know sometimes can be a little on the inflammatory side, reading the media and listening to the media here in Monterey. Monterey County seems to be taking a more moderate approach and seems to be unsure about the direction that they really want to go with the homeless population. They're kind of teetering on, should we take a draconian law enforcement approach, or should we take a more compassionate let's help homeless people either have a higher quality of life as homeless persons or assist them into some sort of sheltered situation. So that's why, in fact, that's why I wrote the article, because I wanted to suggest to Monterey County that, you know, look at what's happened in Santa Cruz, and do we want to replicate this in Monterey County? And my hope would be no.
So you're suggesting that the anti-homeless laws recently passed, which includes the laws passed 2 days ago, although you didn't have those in mind when you wrote the article, but the earlier anti-homeless laws, prohibitions against sleeping and camping, prohibitions against being in parks after dark, prohibitions against sitting near a building, peacefully having a sign asking for a dime after dark, prohibitions against recycling, picking up recycling materials and turning them in. All this stuff have had a negative impact on either on the... I guess you're not claiming it has a negative or positive effect on the crime rate. You're suggesting how it has an impact on the homelessness rate or in Santa Cruz?
I'm sorry. I'm not following. So you're talking about the ordinance...
You're suggesting Monterey County not follow the example of Santa Cruz County, and I'm saying is that example in your eyes something that means these nasty laws produce a worse situation, and if so, in what respects worse, other than if you're homeless, it's harder for you if you're a homeless person?
Well, it seems to me they're simply ineffective, and so I'm not sure what impact it has on the homeless community. But in terms of economically, it makes little or no sense. It seems to be only satisfying some need that people have to say we're doing something to either to rid ourselves of what people would consider a problem. I see all of those things being highly ineffective because the homeless population, and my argument in the article is, they're not going to go away. And you're not going to be able to force them out or ordinance them out, just like we weren't able to incarcerate our way out of, you know, what the drug problems are in America. So we end up with, you know, 2 million people incarcerated or under some sort of law enforcement authority. We tried to incarcerate our way out of that. We're certainly not going to ordinance our way out of the homeless problem. It's just simply not going to happen. So it's ineffective. It only affects people on an emotional level. Give them a feeling like we're doing something. We're making, you know, progress. We're gonna get the homeless out of Santa Cruz. As far as the homeless population, you know, it's going to push them, you know, further out into areas that have little or no law enforcement. It's not going to assist them in transitioning into housing. It's not going to, I'm not sure. I mean, clearly it's going to lower their quality of life because they're just going to pick up, you know, a bunch of nuisance violations, which again, there's very little chance they're going to pay. There's, you know, the cost of incarceration, the hassle of incarceration, the hassle of being known to the legal system. I mean, it's really a no-win situation to try to fix this problem through creating more rules.
We're talking with Doug Loisel, who's currently director of a methadone clinic in Salinas. Is that right?
Yeah, off Main Clinic.
And formerly, you were a director of the Homeless Lack of Services Center, as I like to call it, here in Santa Cruz. Actually, I've been calling it the Lack of Shelter Center, since it's really provides a few services, meals, showers, access to washing machines. And I guess for some, there's access to eventually programs like the Page Smith Community House and maybe the Breboli Family Shelter. What services actually, if you've been keeping an eye on it, and I don't know that it's changed substantially since you left in 2009, does the Santa Cruz Homeless, what I call lack of shelter center, provide?
What are their current services?
Yeah, as far as you know. Oh.
As far as I know, I think they have they still have the Family Transitional Center, the Reboli Family Center, which takes in families. That's a transitional, I believe it's a 6-month program.
Let me interrupt here, because if the average homeless person walks up to the Homeless Lack of Services Center, what services is he likely to be able to get? Or she?
I think that he can get
access to a bathroom, access
locker,
to two meals a day.
Shower,
what else? You can't get a locker anymore. The lockers are all gone.
Okay, I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah.
And I think I believe that they can also receive medical treatment on campus. I know that there's a health center there.
Homeless Persons
bathroom.
Health Project.
Yeah, HPHP, I think.
Yeah.
Homeless Persons Health. And then... Mm-hmm. And then if you, I believe, get on a waiting list, you can get into the emergency shelter program. I think you can stay up to 30 days. And then you've also got...
you're talking about the Pauley Loft. But when you walk in, you're not going to get sheltered on that night. You probably aren't going to get sheltered for several months. And once you do get sheltered, we're talking about 46 beds in the Pauley Loft, which actually are now occupied completely by the Page Smith Community House people. And also by people coming out of the jails based upon the new program that is requiring, you know, that instead of the governor's releasing people from the state prisons who are drug war criminals and so forth,
right,
and low-impact criminals, he is forcing these people into community jails. And indeed, today, the newspapers reported that the legislature has almost unanimously gone along with his latest scam. That's in my view, Governor Brown's scam, that in essence claims that there isn't overcrowding, that he's addressed the issues of overcrowding in the prisons, which has been denied by the courts. And I got to admit, I have not researched directly the issue of overcrowding in the courts except through reading essentially partisan accounts denouncing the overcrowding. But let me ask you about that. Do you have any sense of that based upon your, your work in the community as to... It seems to me that this whole business of watching people in jails die at a much more significantly increased rate because of lack of medical care and overcrowding, and that's been ignored by the last decade, is something real and tangible, and that has essentially been endlessly whitewashed by Brown and previous governors. But what's your view on that?
Well, you know, first and foremost, you know, we've made some effort for whatever reason to incarcerate our way out of social problems. And, you know, I think we're coming to the realization now. I think AB 109 is what you're referring to.
Right.
And, you know, once again, you know, incarcerating people for nonviolent, generally speaking, nonviolent drug-related offenses, it just simply doesn't work. It's ineffective. It doesn't motivate people to stop using drugs. It's just a costly, it's just a costly mess that was created.
I mean, I don't think we disagree on that. My question to you, though, is whether specifically the toxic conditions in the prison, are we to pay more attention to the judges or to the governor and his legislature, who are essentially, I am afraid, pandering to this lock them up, throw away the keys, stack them up like cordwood, watch them die approach, rather than, you know, what's really going on in terms of just sort of elementary conditions in jails, which ultimately, if people are dying in prisons because of crappy conditions, that costs the state more in the event that their relatives hire attorneys and sue these places, I would think.
Well, of course. I mean, the prison system has failed, and it is failing. And I'm not overly familiar with, you know, the general conditions within the prisons. I don't know really.
Yeah, the reason I brought it up, Doug, is because this is putting additional stress on the homeless lack of shelter center here in Santa Cruz, as well as on the so-called 180-180 program and all the other social services. This essentially prisoner dumping instead of simply releasing them directly, statewide, is resulting in hardships for people who are, you know, outside, who have been seeking services for years and aren't getting them, because people from the prisons who actually have been getting those services, ironically enough, because to some extent, because they've been in jail,
right,
are now dumped on the outside. So I was just pointing out that I was trying to get your view of how things were. What real services can one person expect walking up to the homeless lack of shelter center? And I usually kind of know, I can tell them, well, you can use a bathroom or a porta potty day or night until they put in this $100,000 security gate, of course, because that's what's now been apportioned by both the county and the city under the approving eye of Monica Martinez, the current executive director. And so I guess you can get meals, you can get access to laundry.
Right.
You can.
To sum it up, you can get basic services.
Most basic service,
yeah,
of shelter, even sanctuary during the day, you cannot get, because you can't stay there. You can't hang out there at all unless you have some excuse.
Yeah, well, there is this, I've kind of reversed my opinion about this, but there's been this push for many, many years, you know, the 10-year plan to eliminate homelessness. And the 10-year plan to eliminate homelessness has been going on for about 30 years, and nothing has changed. There's been this push to transit, and I think generally speaking, it's by HUD, to transition homeless persons into permanent safe housing. And because of this, there has been this kind of backlash where they won't let people hang out at a homeless shelter. Everybody has to exit during the day. The reason for this is everybody's got to be looking for a job. Everybody's got to be trying to find employment, trying to find social services. And in some programs, they'll even make you take a piece of paper and, you know, show that you've gone to three different, you know, placement agencies. And so this push to move people from homelessness to sheltered, although I think the intention is right, or the intention is good, it's kind of backfired, because now people, they can't even stay, you know, like you say, during the day. And I guess they have a homeless free zone?
No impact zone around the homeless lack of shelter center. Again, to pander to the bigotry and fears and apprehensions of local businesses and residents out there, similar to, you know, the kind of paranoia that greets drug treatment centers when they come into neighborhoods and
right.
other social services. I mean, it's a traditional kind of apprehension, which I haven't studied the figures, you know, so I don't know if any of it is justified. I tend to be suspicious of that kind of what I consider bigotry immediately. We're talking with Doug Lozell of the, what's the name of the methadone clinic you're working at?
Off Main Clinic, Community Human Services.
Say it once more.
Community Human Services Off Main Clinic.
And of course,
it's a methadone treatment program for persons addicted to opiates, opiates such as, you know, Vicodin, Oxycontin, heroin,
right.
et cetera.
What's your background, Doug, that qualifies you as an expert in this area in any way that, you know, that you would want, that people can gain some kind of sense? You've done some research and some work on it. Not that I'm a big fan of expertise credentials, but what do you got?
Not much. As far as homelessness or methadone?
Both.
Well, I've been working in social services for about 25 years. I hold a doctorate in clinical psychology. I hold a master's degree in marriage and family therapy and a bachelor's degree in religion and another master's degree in educational administration. I ran a homeless shelter in LA that had about 480 clients, and then I ran a HIV AIDS housing project that had transitional and permanent housing, provided state licensed child care, and then I worked with foster families for many years. I don't know if that's
That sounds nice. On the other hand, you know, I've been corresponding with Palo Alto activists who have been noting the hungry response of what they call poverty pimps to snap up grants in the wake of the vehicle habitation ban that was passed by Palo Alto City Council, essentially with no stats whatsoever really indicating any, you know, criminal problems with people in vehicles.
Right.
And in essence, what they want to do is they're going to strip these people of their right to survive in a vehicle, and that will then throw them into shelters and this pseudo-search for housing. I call it a pseudo-search because I would again ask, if you're to compare the government programs building housing in the 70s with the actual amount of housing that's being provided under this 180-180 or 10-year end homelessness consortium of care or whatever the latest fashionable slogan is, you might know more about this than I do. I would ask whether there was a much greater amount of housing being produced than the now. And so this is really, you know, it's money for bombers over Afghanistan and, you know, drones over these countries and that sort of thing, rather than any kind of a local any kind of housing, which has been abandoned as a priority in the 80s.
Well, you know, I think if you don't want people to be homeless, if you want homelessness to go away, then you need to provide shelter. Okay, and it's a simple equation. It's not complicated. Okay, and it needs to be non-discriminatory shelter, which means that the shelters that have zero tolerance for drugs and alcohol, the housing first model, I actually believe works. Providing housing before you require somebody to become abstinent from drugs and alcohol. So if you want the homeless,
well, we don't disagree there. But my question is, what's the magnitude of the investment that's happening? It seems to me that this is a slogan without effectuating funding that really creates the housing.
Instead, I agree.
It's bullshit, in other words, for me, compared with, you know, I'm in certainly not adequate programs in the 70s, but I draw my information from groups that have, like the Western Regional Advocacy Project, the Coalition on Homelessness in San Francisco, research by Paul Bowden and other activists who claim that the cutoff of housing programs in the 80s essentially created lots of homelessness, along with, of course, the recessions and the, you know, the tinkle-down theories of economics during those days.
There's a tremendous amount of money that's put into kind of these shiny pilot projects, right? Rather than taking an apartment building and renovating it, which is, you know, could be fairly low cost, there's this push to build, you know, new large family type shelters or SRO housing.
Pay fancy salaries. Pay a lot of social workers for, you know, help showing people how to tie their shoelaces and write checks and things like that.
Yeah, there's a significant amount of money that go. In fact, you know, social services in general and housing persons is labor intensive. Most of the money goes to salaries and benefits.
And this leads to me to a whole interest group and bureaucracy whose concern, whatever they think they're doing, is actually perpetuating homelessness in this, because it continues their jobs. It continues what they're doing. This is what, of course, people on the right wing often say, you know, that the homeless lack of services center is simply a slush fund, and it's not a very rich slush fund, admittedly, for the people who work there. But in fact, this is also what advocates on the left are saying in Palo Alto, that this kind of destruction of homeless people's right to provide their own shelter gives a shot in the arm to folks so they can continue their salaried work, essentially, of funneling people through an endless merry-go-round that leads nowhere.
Yeah, and I would agree with that.
Even though a lot of your career has been involved in being in those kinds of services?
Yes. And, I made a significant amount of money working in social services. There is the argument that, you have to pay people a certain amount of money if you're going to get high-quality employees. I don't think I was ever a real high-quality employee. But I certainly was well paid for what I did.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Doug Loisel of Carmel, I guess. Are you one of those fancy homes in Carmel, perhaps?
No, I actually live in a house behind a house. So
a house behind a house. I see one.
I'm a renter.
And I got to ask you about Carmel. Before I do, let me announce, if people want to call and have any questions for Doug, there is an open line here. If you want to call and ask a question of Doug, if anybody's listening on the stream, unfortunately, we're still not broadcasting on the air, but I have heard that we'll be trying to be putting up a transmitter in the next few days. So that is likely to happen. What's happening in Carmel for homeless people? Is it true what Councilmember Mike Rotkin of Santa Cruz used to say? Is we're great humanitarians in Santa Cruz. In Carmel, they just arrest you and dump you on the edge of town.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot of there's not a whole lot of homeless people in Carmel that I've seen. From what I've seen, there tends to be some level of tolerance here. I haven't seen anybody hassled or anything like that. It's just that Carmel is not a city, for whatever reason, that the homeless migrate towards. And I'm not sure why, to be honest with you.
Do you have laws in Carmel against sleeping, sitting on the sidewalk, being in a park after dark? You don't know, do you?
I don't know.
Doug
Loisel. I don't know. I'm sorry.
All right. Well, next time I expect you to research this because, it's where you live, and that's one of your primary responsibilities. However you may commute to Salinas, speaking as your pastor, your responsibility is to deal with your hometown there, so to speak.
Duly noted.
Good. By the way, I may have a questioner in the studio. Another radio broadcaster has come in who's been covering the homeless scene himself, also the civil liberties scene. How do you want to introduce yourself?
It doesn't matter. No introduction.
We'll call him No Intro Guy. Go ahead.
Someone that worked for the city of Carmel told me once that their solution was the homeless, along with probably all the other laws, was just to not have any benches anywhere. you can't really sit down in that town. Is that true?
You know, we have benches here. Okay. he may have been being flippant. I'm not sure, but yeah, there's benches here.
Go ahead.
Well, I mean, if you don't see any homeless, there's some reason, because it's a very nice temperature. That's the magnet effect, is because they don't freeze at night. That's why they come to, you know, California and Florida and places like that.
Yeah, you know, Carmel's kind of divided up in, you know, Carmel Valley and then kind of the downtown area. And Carmel Valley is much, much warmer than out, you know, where the shops and where people, you know, might, you know, panhandle or something like that. It's a little colder in that area. There's, you know, a little microclimate issue here, I think.
You'd ever get panhandled?
You know, I don't really spend a whole lot of time here, to be honest with you.
Well, let's switch to Salinas, because that's where you work, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And the Salinas Methadone Clinic is in what part of town? The fashionable upscale neighborhood, or?
We're on North Main, and there's another clinic, Valley Health Associates, that's closer to Chinatown. And Chinatown would be where the homeless are really concentrated in Salinas. You know, there's other areas, but Chinatown tends to be where the homeless congregate.
Well, I heard there was an actual homeless encampment that was supported by what, Dorothy's Place in Chinatown?
Yeah. There's homeless encampments right in that area, and they rouse them, you know, probably every 3 to 6 months, right in there. They give people an opportunity to gather their stuff together. Anything that's left behind, you know, is taken and, you know, disposed of. And then, you know, essentially, after a few days, they just move back in. I'm not sure. I do know there's also, I believe it's part of their Parks and Recreation, where they employ a lot of the homeless persons to, you know, sweep the streets and, you know, be involved in community cleanups. There seems to be more of a mutual understanding in Salinas. The person, the guy who beat the homeless man is, you know, what is not indicative of the overall culture that I've seen in Salinas. You know, Salinas has a significantly more pressing problem of gangs, and so the homelessness kind of takes a back seat to that. So our clinics serve people from everywhere, from, you know, Carmel here to King City. People from Chinatown come to our clinic, from Monterey, Pacific Grove. So we kind of pull in people from all over kind of the Monterey Peninsula and Salinas Valley.
So, for those, again, want to call in and talk with Doug before we oust him from the air, which will be fairly shortly because we have all kinds of crap to play from the last city council meeting, call in at 831-469-3119. Again, 831-469-3119. I know in Monterey County, I went down there with Indy Bay activist Alex DeRosi to check out the city council's consideration of, it wasn't actually a, this was no smoking, no sitting, it was a number of anti-homeless ordinances. I guess there was a permitted parking ordinance for a section of the city, there was a no smoking ban on the wharf, and then there was a sitting ban in downtown Monterey. And it wasn't even laws that were being proposed. It was a study of the laws. And even the study was voted down by the city council because so many people showed up overwhelmingly to oppose those measures. Contrast that with Santa Cruz, where 2 days ago, the majority of people who testified at city council against the two new laws that make it, you know, expand the no-smoking zone to the side alleys and streets beyond Pacific Avenue, and that also contract the space for street vendors, street performers, political tablers by about, I would guess, I estimated four-fifths, which is, sounds rather extreme, and they no wise admitted that, but that's my analysis of how much they've shrunk the ability of space, the ability of the street performer or the street activist who has what they call a display device, which is, you know, anything, actually, that is in a horizontal position that can hold anything. That's what's called a display device. Not a sign, but just a cup, a guitar case, a table, you name it, a blanket. And they banned having blankets on the sidewalk as, you know, something to put your jewelry on or your artwork on or your guitar on. Now you have to carry your own table or you have
or
to have
box.
Or have a box or something raised. And
right.
Also they've contracted the area from 18 square feet for the display device alone to a total of 16 square feet for everything, including your personal possessions. They've extended the setback area from 10 feet from everywhere, like a building, a crosswalk, a kiosk, a phone booth. There's about 10 or 12 different objects you can't be within 10 feet of at the present day, but in a month and a half, it'll be 14 feet from all those objects. Plus, you have to be 12 feet away from the next person.
Even your friend, the next display device.
Okay.
And you know, when you go through all that, the first thing that comes to my mind is that's a hell of a lot of policing to do.
That's the irony.
That's why we spend so much money.
The irony is,
for the love of God,
you would think so, but unfortunately, we are living in such a police compliant society. People are so desperate to keep their jobs, not to get involved. I mean, how often have you decided to take a risk to confront a police officer, Doug, on your way to work? You know, I mean, think about it. It ain't going to happen that much. I mean, it happens with, you know, the occasional maverick like myself and a few other ne'er-do-wells who are willing to stand up and say, hey, what's going on here? But for most people, it's, oh, yes, sir, no, sir, three bags full.
Right, of course. But, I mean, how the hell are they going to police all that? And then didn't the DA in Santa Cruz, doesn't he need two more attorneys?
He's got them already. He's hired him. And not only that, he's continuing with his political prosecutions of the Santa Cruz 11. That's a Bob Lee, or Big Top Bob, as I like to call him, because it's a huge circus.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to clog the system with all this nuisance, you know, crap, what do you expect going to happen? And then so they have to go ahead and hire these new attorneys because, you know, all the other attorneys are dealing with all this other shit.
Yeah. They have larger budgets. That's what they want.
And apparently this is not stopping them. And you see, what we're doing, I know, for example, at the last Huff meeting, we met yesterday, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the group I work with, met. And it had been usually a large meeting, and we actually decided to hold a protest on the downtown Pacific Avenue sidewalk next Sunday after next in front of Forever 21. You're invited, by the way, Doug, to come back to town for a triumphant return, if you'd like.
Lord. God help us.
Indeed.
Just stay 14 feet away from everything.
Yes.
They won't let me within 14 feet of Santa Cruz, just so you know.
No, well, that's we will defend you with the People's Guard here.
With vigor.
We have a masked Avenger, actually, who at one point invaded the county building and presented the... do you remember, you had that man on your show, Free.
I never had him on the show.
No, you didn't? I thought you discussed him on the show, right?
Yeah.
And what did this guy do at the county building?
Well, it's because they take the sleeping bags of the indigents when they arrest them, release them because the jails are all full, but keep the sleeping bags so they're outside freezing in the cold and possibly dying. That's a deliberate indifference.
And so you presented you deported on the guy who essentially went up in a mask to the county sheriff's department and presented them with a notice, sort of putting them on notice that they were stealing property and they would then be legally liable.
Well, and if someone dies, you know, that was his point.
Of course, five people have died in the jails, and a number of people have died outside. The question, I guess, is what's the next step for those of us on the streets or in homes who aren't on the streets but want to be helpful to deal with the issue? And you, I know you've not really been an activist on this issue, Doug, as much as a bureaucrat, social service provider. I've felt of all the social service providers in Santa Cruz that I remember, you have to go back to A guy called Andrew in the early 90s to find people who were as advocate, as much an advocate as you were. Because of course, you got kicked out of town for it, among other things.
Among other things,
and we've talked about that on the air, too, phony charges of sexual molestation and so forth.
You
weren't a member of Take Back Santa Cruz, were you? They seem to harbor molesters there.
Yeah. We've had that recently. That one guy who was instrumental in setting up the Clean Team website and was a part of Take Back Santa Cruz.
Oh, I saw that.
He has been seriously charged with all kinds of.
That was tragedy on about 50 levels. I mean, the whole thing. That's really sad.
But you were aware of your charges.
So the question was what can the common guy do, or?
Yeah, well,
what are the weaknesses in the bureaucracy? Because that's what's doing it to everyone.
Well, the weakness in the bureaucracy is militant ignorance. You know, it's the willful attempt to be ignorant about what's working and what's not working. And clearly, what's not working is what is being attempted presently. As I said in my article, if you don't want homeless people, provide shelter. If you don't want people to be walking around with dirty clothes, provide laundry services. If you don't want people to be dirty, then provide showers, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, provide basic services on a level that can meet the needs of the large population you have in Santa Cruz, not just a slice of it. And I don't have anything against homeless services center, or I don't know Monica Martinez. I've never met her. I don't have any real opinion about that, other than that's just such a small slice. And I don't know if that's to alleviate people's guilt or whatever. You've got to provide services on a much larger level. If you don't want people to urinate and defecate in public, then provide public bathrooms that are accessible.
Exactly.
As far as, the bureaucracy is concerned, and, the local government, look at the empirical research. Look at what works, and look at what's not working, and be realistic about it. Don't just give in to something because the constituency is pressuring you in one way or another. Look at what's actually working. Don't just try to satiate people's need to feel like they're doing something because we're going to be tough on the homeless. We're going to rid the community of the scourge. Look at it from an empirical, research-based perspective. See what's working and what's not working, and make changes. And I kind of summarize, my philosophy.
You have to find the other end of it.
Yeah, the problem is the people in the bureaucrats are making a lot of money, but they don't really care whether the homeless are housed or fed or have somewhere to go to the bathroom. They're just there to get the money. I mean, they tore the storage lockers out of the homeless service center, got rid of charged for mail.
I was thinking about this today. It's hard to overestimate the importance of Huff, and I'm not just saying this because I like you, Robert, but the work that Robert does, because it keeps the pressure on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important work because it keeps a steady flow of pressure on the people who are making decisions, and illuminates the reality of what's happening, rather than it just being kind of sucked up and regurgitated by the mainstream media. And so I can't comment on somebody's conscience, or although you can comment on it according to their behavior, but I can't really comment on their conscience. But if they're making decisions that aren't in the best interest of the entire community, which includes the homeless, then, people like Robert are important because it keeps a steady flow of pressure on them to make decisions that benefit the entire community.
I think you overestimate my, and I'm not just trying to be modest. I think we present I try to present a dissenting view for the purposes of clarifying what I think the truth of the matter is from my perspective. I don't represent anybody. And I often get criticized, even by people like yourself, Free, for being utterly ineffective and failing.
I didn't say utterly.
Well, generally ineffective and all over the place. And
the time versus the result.
And the amount of time
put on a lot of time.
So he's a well-intended dolt kind of approach. But, you know, be it as it may, it is sort of what I do. Again, we've been talking with Doug Loisel. And, Doug, I'm going to give you an opportunity to sum up, give you a chance to question if you had any more questions for Doug or comments. And we also have another person in the studio who's been a street performer down in Santa Cruz and has kept her finger on the pulse of what's been going on down there because she regularly spends time on Pacific Avenue. Valerie. Hey, Valerie, do you have any comments you want to make or any questions of Doug or anything that's come to mind as you've heard any of this?
Actually, not a whole lot right now. I'm keeping up with everything, but I don't have any comments.
that's something. Anything you got, Free?
I'm not sure.
Okay, well, look, Doug, I'm going to recommend to people that they check out your article, which should be posted soon on the Huff blog at huffsantacruz.org. And the name of that article, again, is... I've got to find it.
Monterey, take a page from... Santa Cruz.
Let Monterey County take a page from Santa Cruz.
Right. I think that's good.
And I expect you to do a thorough research into the homeless scene in Carmel before our next discussion so that we know the real truth behind Mike Rotkin's claim that Santa Cruz is so much more compassionate than Carmel because Carmel just doesn't allow homeless people at all in its environs.
Yeah, I'll have a full report.
Excellent.
For you.
That's between commuting to Salinas and struggling to beat back foreclosure in your own. So I guess you don't own any homes though. So you're.
I do. Yeah, I also own a home.
Oh, you do own a home. So
in Los Angeles.
Oh, so you're one of those wealthy one percenters we've heard so much about.
I like to refer to myself as an aristocrat.
Indeed.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't consider myself a wealthy one percenter.
You wouldn't consider yourself a wealthy one percenter.
I think I would consider myself a very fortunate person that purchased a home back when homes were actually affordable.
Hear, hear.
Well, many decades ago.
Thank you for calling in, and thank you for writing that article. And you know. We don't seem to have too many people listening or at least calling in, but maybe
back when we're up on the air.
Maybe when we get back on the air, which hopefully will be in a couple of days if we can get things together. That'll happen. And thank you for calling, Doug. How can people reach you and get more information? Have you got a website? Have you got somewhere you can be reached?
My website is Loisel Consulting. .com, and then people can email me, and you can give them my email address if you'd like. I think you have it, dbruceloisel@gmail.
One more time,
dbruceloisel@gmail.com.
Fair enough. And if anybody has more questions about that, they can give me a call on the Huff line at 423-HUFF, 423-4833, which is where you can find either me or my machine off times. Thanks, Doug, for calling in, and keep
thanks,
up the good work.
Thanks, Robert. Always fascinating, and I really appreciate the work you do, and I mean that very sincerely.
Well, thanks.
Bye-bye. All right. Bye-bye. Take care.
And you are tuned to the stream of Free Radio Santa Cruz at freakradio.org, where you can go to make donations, offer opportunity sites, as the city council so discreetly likes to put it, for our transmitter. We are looking for a place to put our transmitter. Yes, we may go back on the air temporarily, but
we still need a
long-term transmitter site. And so if you know of a second story or a tree and right outside the trophy area in the middle of downtown Santa Cruz,
the west side or the east side,
then we can use that. Traditionally, there haven't been any significant sanctions against landlords who have done this, although we've had to leave one after another once they were threatened.
That's usually it. We just move it every year. Like, Yeah, or, true guerrilla style.
is what I say to that.
You need a van, then.
Yeah, right. Maybe a van to travel around. Although then you might be accused of living in our vehicle. Although it's legal in Santa Cruz to live in your vehicle, just not to sleep in your vehicle.
After 11.
Oh, you can have, well, you can have a blanket in the vehicle after 11. You can't have a blanket outside, though, you see. It's an interesting distinction.
A piece of it comes out the window. But now,
you go. You toss it out the window. No, you toss it in the window, I guess, if they come by. If you can find a van to toss it into. So if you want to call in, the phone lines are open, 427-3772. I'm now going to turn to the little-known, little-heard task force meeting of... it was actually last Wednesday when John Barisone, Wednesday before last, when John Barisone spoke before the mayor's hand-picked group of Blame It on the Homeless gang that is cooking up a whole series of pretexts for both the existing bureaucratic structure of repression, as well as, I would imagine, new measures as well. Mm-hmm. I began to play this last time, and this is supposed to be posted on the task force website, which you can find through going to the City of Santa Cruz website, but it is not. Still not. They're having, apparently they say they're having trouble, and I know when I press them, they do tend to take action. They either send it to me directly or start posting it. So apparently, in some respects, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. And we do.
Transparency in government,
and that's how you do.
You are effective there.
You hold them. Well, I'm more effective than not, I guess, in some respects. Mm-hmm. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to, if I can find the right place, I'm going to play a little something from that particular task force meeting, and that was John Barisone. He discusses legal issues which might interest you a lot, Free, since you've done a lot of research and have a particular interest in this area, I know. So keep your ears peeled, and that includes you, Valerie, if you've got some thoughts. We'll see if I can find the proper...
Turn up the sound, since there are no good headphones here.
This is going to be the city council meeting?
This is the meeting of a group that is a task force on public safety, which really means, as I said before, a task force, which is...
Handpicked by the mayor.
Handpicked by Mayor Hillary Bryant, without any input from the city council or the public, without any homeless advocates or homeless individuals or civil libertarians or public defenders. It's all sort of set up at the beginning to reflect a certain cast of mind, in my view. So I'm now going to... I started playing this last time, and it got cut off. I'm going to try picking up pretty much from where I left off, and we'll see if we can actually get somewhere with this. And you can call in 427-3772.
They love growing up here. We love raising them here.
John Barisone, in terms of
my commitment to the community, it's always been both a professional commitment as city attorney, but like many other people in the community, it was a personal commitment because this is where we raised our kids. They all loved growing up here, would never let me leave the community because they loved it so much. Like a lot of our children trying to figure out ways to get back there because they can see themselves living here in the future if they can figure out a way to do it. So that's sort of where I come from. My purpose here tonight is to explain how the system is currently working with respect to the sort of quality of life crimes that are municipal code infractions. And these are infractions such as, you know, open container laws, dogs on the mall after dark, being in parks after posted hours, public urination, public defecation, camping, smoking where smoking's not allowed, things of these nature. They're all infractions under our Santa Cruz Municipal Code.
John Barisone, who you hear speaking, has been the city attorney for 25 years, more or less, maybe a little less. He's also city attorney for the city of Capitola. He is also...
Double dipper.
Quite so. And he also, more than that, because he gets paid additionally for more stuff that he does, as well as getting a standard fee, he gets paid additionally for time he spends on other city issues.
And he's getting a pension as an independent contractor.
Is that right? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
But I know that this quality of life stuff he talks about, which really is a quality of slow death for homeless people, because by having all these kinds of restrictions, you make it much harder for them to be able to survive outside.
Well, You notice every crime that he mentioned there would be legal if you had a house and were doing it there.
Quite so. I mean, I don't have all of them in mind, but I think you're right on that generally. He initiated these laws, partially under the impetus of the police department, partially under the impetus of conservatives in the city staff like Julie Hendy and other right-wingers. But he has been a sort of... It's very hard to find liberal legislation that Barisone has actually initiated. One instance would be an exception to that, was the sleeping ban waiting list provision, which asserts that you are not subject to the sleeping and camping ordinances if you are on a waiting list for the Homeless Lack of Services Center or the River Street Shelter, and the tickets will be automatically dismissed. This, however, was prompted by...
By Peace Camp 2010 and Ed Fry's insistent that it's harassment to just not just call the shelter and find out if there's beds instead of harassing people. So this was Barisone's alternative to that, to make sure that he couldn't be sued on those grounds.
The three-month-long vigil in front of the county building and City Hall, which at its height had 50 or 60 homeless people and a porta potty supply, the only one in the city open to everybody, by attorney and activist Ed Fry, for which he was later convicted with a 6-month jail sentence as a crime. The crime is being lodging. He wasn't convicted of having a dirty porta potty. He wasn't convicted of denouncing the authorities, although his porta potty was clean, but his denunciations were repeated and appropriate.
And he was let off in shackles when he said shame, shame on to the judge.
Yes,
judge
he was let Gallagher. Off in shackles when he refused to accept
the sentence.
He said he wasn't coming back, and they said, okay, we'll lock you up right now, and they shackled him up. He eventually did house arrest. He had a house arrest bracelet on his ankle, I guess is what it was.
Mm-hmm. What a criminal.
He was.
Well, as to that waiting list, anybody who does get on the waiting list, Huff has now forced the Homeless Service Center to provide receipts. Huff has actually printed up the receipts at their own expense and placed them there, but you have to ask for them. Then when a cop hassles you for sleeping, you just pull out your receipt and they won't arrest you, which Brent told me that a cop told him that. So it is having some effect.
And in fact, however, what they're doing now instead, as I mentioned in a recent posting, was they're using, sounds like somewhat imaginary trespass laws or trespass warnings, claiming that we won't give you a camping ticket, we will give you a trespass ticket, which cannot be dismissed through this process because only camping tickets can be dismissed.
Oh, well, then just sleep on the sidewalk because you can't trespass on the sidewalk
you would
at
think
any
so.
Hour.
But those who did that during the April protest at the post office.
Then you get obstructing, but make sure you're not obstructing.
Yes, and they weren't. You can't obstruct an 80-foot sidewalk in that area, which is where it was hugely wide, right near approaching the town clock, coming out of the post office. So this is John Barisone, who produced these laws, who wrote them up. And some of it you might have to say, well, he's a city attorney, he has to do what the cops and so forth tell him to do. But the other, he
could tell him no. He could say, no, we can't do anything about it.
There are city attorneys, very few. There is one city attorney who refused adamantly to write a law criminalizing feeding of homeless people in the parks. And that was the city attorney of Santa Monica in the 80s. Robert Myers. He refused to do it, and he was the city council tried to fire him, but they required a 5-2 vote or something to fire him, and they couldn't. So eventually, they were able to get rid of him, but he made a principled stand, and it was inspiring. And I actually, I don't know how sweet a personality he is. I've never found him the most approachable guy, but the fact that he did this is really was really moving to me. Barisone is different. Let's hear more from Barisone testifying before a group of people who I think probably agree with all these anti-homeless laws he's pushed and probably want more.
And under the Santa Cruz City Charter, the city attorney, not the district attorney's office, is responsible for prosecuting those violations. The way it typically works and the way it's supposed to work, if everything goes correctly, is a police officer or park ranger observes an infraction as a violation of the municipal code. He approaches the individual and issues that individual a citation. Technically, while the citation is being issued and the individual is being detained, that person is under arrest. When that person signs the citation, if you read the fine print under the signature, the person is promising to appear. So,
a couple of points here. He is under arrest. So when you're given a citation, if you ever have the opportunity to get an attorney at any time in the future, which can be very difficult, you can technically sue for false arrest. Although the damages that you have to show may be slight by writing a citation. But the other thing is that in Santa Cruz, the police general orders do not require you to sign a promise to appear or to sign that citation.
Then they may hang on to you, though, and then you have more damages.
Right. Well, you can decline to sign the citation, saying, you know, I cannot promise to appear at this point, not because I don't wish to cooperate with you, because I feel this is unconstitutionally issued. They may take you to jail
and hold you until trial.
But they also are required under their general orders, if the courts are open, if it is during daylight hours, to take you to a judge for a probable cause hearing. And there was a time a decade ago when a number of us used this to try to slow up this infernal juggernaut, whereby people were being scared into signing citations and appearing in jail and getting big fines, then getting hassled and leaving town by forcing the police officers who were so busily engaged in this work to have to go to court during the day. And I think we found in almost every case, there weren't very many cases. I think Becky Johnson did it once around a chalking ticket. She chalked something like the sleeping ban is a crime on the sidewalk, and they arrested her for, it wasn't quite graffiti, it was marks on the sidewalk. But she did get to go down, and it is a part of the general orders of the police department, which, as I've said before on the show, are a better way of challenging the police department than claiming they're violating the law. They couldn't care less, really, if they're violating the law. But if they're violating the general orders, that puts their jobs in jeopardy. It also subjects them to interrogation by their superiors that they're not allowed not to answer. Unlike an ordinary citizen, if you're asked questions by your superior as a police officer, it's kind of like the military. You have to answer or risk losing your job.
Also under federal law, that trip to the magistrate to determine whether there was enough probable cause to arrest you has to occur within 48 hours. And they can't be longer than that without a very, very good excuse, and it being a weekend is not a valid excuse.
Well, you're thinking, actually, I think, free of your right to be taken before a judge to be informed of the charges. The writ of habeas corpus is really what it is. The right to be speedily taken before a judge. There's an additional protection in the California Code for being taken to a magistrate immediately, for example, for a vehicle code violation or an infraction violation. I think also for a misdemeanor violation.
Well, the reason I bring it up is they commonly will arrest someone on this is without a warrant too. They'll commonly arrest someone on a Friday, and then you can't see a judge till Monday. So they lock you up for two days.
Oh, for sure, or arrest you at night, and you can't do it. In theory, they're supposed to have a magistrate's clerk at the jail who is supposed to, is what I've been told, determine if there's no probable cause basis. You're supposed to be immediately released. But if anybody wants to use this approach, if you're, for example, cited at around noon on a weekday, you can say, I'd like to be taken before a magistrate now in order to determine there's a probable cause hearing. Is there a problem with that?
And this is, again, if they do it without a warrant, because the warrant is issued by a judge.
Without a warrant. So I mean, and most citations in Santa Cruz, infractions, harassment citations downtown, are done without warrants.
But like when they grabbed Becky for the Santa Cruz 11, they had a warrant.
Right, but that was for a felony.
Yeah.
It's a little different. But, you know, for everybody sitting near a building, for smoking on the sidewalk, for sleeping, they don't get warrants for this kind of stuff. They just give people citations. More than that, they just threaten to give people citations in order to move them out, force them away.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's no room in the jails now with the governor pushing all the serious criminals into our jails. So they don't really have room to put people in jail for all this little stuff. So, if you wanted to refuse to sign, I mean, take your chances.
I didn't mean to spend all this time on it myself. I apologize. But let's hear more with John.
It's a tactic people can use.
So it is. And I haven't heard of it used lately. I'd like to know what happens. Maybe I should try it myself again and see where it leads before I lead people down the primary path.
That could happen. But, you know, like my brother Gary, he went to jail. It wasn't the end of the world. He refused probation, you know, and he didn't have probation. And now he's, like, free to leave the country.
But he is still under a two-year probation.
That's right. A suspended sentence.
Suspended sentence.
If he gets busted again within those 2 years, he has to do the whole 2 years for sleeping on three nights.
Right. And with sleeping with a sign, sleeping is not a crime.
Right. Yeah, it was a
protest. On a bench near the courthouse.
First Amendment activity.
Incredible. Let's hear a little more from our own city attorney, John Barisoni.
Essentially, the person is promising to appear in court within 10 days, to get a court date or to pay the...
And as I mentioned before, it's within 30 days, not within 10 days. The courts never will give you a date within 10 days for infraction tickets, and usually takes significantly longer than 30 days to get a court date for a sleeping ticket or a sitting ticket or any of these minor infractions. So John is either a little out of touch with the current scene, or he simply is ignorant of what's going on, or he's misapplying something else. But for those who... Yes, in effect, he isn't really our counsel, he's their counsel.
The fine. So that those are the two alternatives. If you ask for a court date, the court will assign a court date, and the officer who issued the citation will appear at that time, and without an attorney present or necessary, the defendant always has the right to bring an attorney with him or her.
And in the cases where the city has brought in attorneys to prosecute, it's been those cases where political activists have been fighting back. So, for instance, when I was singing downtown with homeless lyrics and bothering Sean Riley, who was apparently trying to sleep at midday right above the bookshop Santa Cruz, or the bookshop Coonerty, as I call it, we were prosecuted and persecuted mercilessly for a year, and that we had the longest infraction trial, but they did provide a city attorney in that regard. But mostly, when you get taken to court, there'll just be a cop who will half the time not show up. Although, say that again?
You tend to get off.
You get off. Yeah. Unless the police officer asks for a continuance, the police officer's failure to appear is the basis for dismissing the ticket, since he's the only witness or she's the only witness against you.
Mm-hmm. So that, again, that's another tactic. If they're going to be issuing all these citations, there's no way they can have all the cops going to the court all the time.
Right, although their approach is going to be probably to try to get you to get the tickets dismissed short of court. Mm-hmm. There's a thing they call homeless courts, which is not really mentioned much. I don't think Barisoni mentions it much. That is a way, essentially, of throwing yourself on the mercy of the court and saying, I'm right. Yeah, basket.
There's no point. There's
Commissioner
no mercy
Basket,
there.
A notoriously
no
bad
mercy
judge.
There.
Well, you throw yourself
not
on the...
Not much legal ability.
Well, it's
either.
Not on the mercy of that court. They have a special homeless court that you have to be vetted for, and it's they were using it in San Francisco over the objections of the Coalition on Homelessness.
You give up your rights for that. No,
and you have to essentially plead guilty and give up all your rights, and then they will settle all your tickets and give you a certain amount of community service and a way of sort of disposing of them. And since homeless people don't want to run around with all these tickets, that is something they've agreed to do.
Wait a minute. All those tickets are fines, right? And you can't pay those fines if you're homeless, so they're like nothing to most of the homeless.
However, the fines then go to collection, and I found not only does collection result in putting a hold on your driver's license, which, as you pointed out, can be significant if you
and
live in your vehicle.
Car registration. Yeah, you forget and your car. If you have a car, you can't.
And then
mess
secondly,
around.
Apparently, they have started accessing your bank accounts. There are now apparently reports that your bank accounts can be accessed by collection agencies.
Yes, that's always been the case. But if you're on SSI, they can't touch your money.
So if homeless people who are trying to get work, who are trying to have a bank account, who are trying to in any way maintain themselves in a normal lifestyle, or I should say the mainstream lifestyle, and struggling to get back into
that
rat race.
The rug. You can't get back out of homeless. They're
right.
Creating a perpetual state of homeless with their antics.
Exactly. Well, that's what, of course, Doug Loisel was saying as well. He was saying that these measures, that they are sort of feel-good or to make the homeless feel bad measures.
Well, they're passed by middle-class people, and to them, a fine is something to fear, but when you're homeless, it's not a deterrent. And then there's no room in the jail, so they're just at a loss what to do. And so they end up, harassing and taking your sleeping bag and, torturing and beating people up and destroying their property because there is no legal solution to the problem.
But John Barisoni, our city attorney, has a solution he's now going to tell you all about.
The judge will decide the case. And these cases are decided in the traffic court. They're infractions. So there's no prison time available. They're just fines or community service. The problem that we have experienced over the last few years is that with the number of these fines, the people are not keeping their promise. They sign the citation, they promise to appear, they don't appear. They don't show up in court to get a court date, or if they do, they don't show up for the court date. And so the question then becomes, what happens after that? And up until 2008, our court treated failures to appear on infraction cases like it treated any other failure to appear. Failure to appear is in and of itself a crime under the California Penal Code. And so up until 2008, when a person failed to appear, a bench warrant was issued for that person's arrest. And with that knowledge and that warrant, the police officer, the police department officer, the next time he or she had contact with that individual, could check the warrants and actually arrest that person and bring them in not only for the underlying offense, but also for the subsequent failure to appear offense. So there was a ready means of taking a person into custody when you contacted him or her. And the statute that authorized that, it's in the Penal Code, it's been there since 1959. It says, when a person signs a written promise to appear at the time and places specified in the written promise to appear and has not posted bail, the magistrate shall issue and have delivered for execution a warrant for his or her arrest within 20 days after his or her failure to appear. So that was how the system worked up until 2008. In 1985, so approximately 23 years prior to 2008, the state legislature enacted another statute that provided an alternative. And what the alternative was, the court would find, has the prerogative for a person who fails to appear, to find that person guilty and assess a fine not to exceed $250. So if you don't appear, the penalty is that you're subject to a fine for $250. And then that fine is sent by the court to a collection agency. And the hammer there is if the fine is unpaid when a person goes to renew his or her driver's license, they don't get their driver's license. And also gets reported to credit reporting services. So that works in a number of instances, but in a number of instances it doesn't work because especially in Santa Cruz with some of our quality of life crimes, the recidivist defenders really don't have an interest. They don't have a driver's license and they don't care about their credit rating. So what we've experienced is that a number, the word is out on the street. We had the problem before, but now the word is out on the street that really there are no ramifications for your failure to appear on infractions if you don't care about your driver's license and you don't care about your credit rating. So,
and it's interesting, though, this fining without trial, because that's what it is. If you don't show up, in the past, they just issue this warrant for you. You know, come into court. Then the courts got wise and realized that local municipalities were overusing these nuisance ordinances and really bankrupting or creating extreme costs for the courts, because they'd bring in homeless people on failures to appear, and then they'd be released again. They'd go do the same thing, sleep again illegally, and get another failure to appear. And so, and this seemed was very costly. So instead, I'm surprised because I know between 1988 and 2009 or so, I knew of virtually nobody who was actually sentenced under this fine approach, where they say, we're not going to issue a failure to appear, we're going to issue a we're going to fine you for not showing up without trial. Usually you get a trial. I mean, the judge may, you know, they can't, if you flee the jurisdiction, they can be looking for you. They can send out a manhunt. They can, you know, they can all kinds of, you're a criminal on the lam, but you're not guilty until you're convicted by a court. Under this 1985 law, which I have not read, but maybe you'll give me some more information on for you if you see it, you're guilty without a trial. I mean, you don't get tried in court. The court will determine you didn't show up, and that in and of itself is sufficient to cause a fine.
Probably because it's just an infraction rather than jail time involved. They can pull that off.
Well, for whatever reason, though, it seems to me to be a violation of due process. And I think it, and that maybe for that reason, I'm just speculating, it wasn't used between 1985 and 2005. Oh, right. I'm sorry, Free. We don't need to hear your mic.
I always turn them all up.
If anybody has any questions, please do call in. The phone lines are open, 427-3772, area code 831, 427-3772. This is the stream of Free Radio. You know, we are live, if you are listening to us, on Thursday, the 12th of September. And you are listening to the Task Force on Public Safety, John Barisoni, city attorney, from about 2 weeks ago.
I'd like to point out that this practice also, the kind of homeless that you end up with, the ones that don't care, they're usually more criminal. You lose the traveling deadheads in their vans and stuff because they have to pay those fines. So they don't come into Santa Cruz anymore. Those niches are replaced by, you know, speed freaks and drunks. And you'll hear everybody in town saying, you know, the people that are against the homeless saying, it's the worst it's ever been. You know, and this is after years of effort by these bozos that are in office. They've created a worse situation for everybody, for the homeless, for the residents. They really all need to be removed, and not just the city council, the city manager. Get rid of that idiot. And
Martin
staff as
Burnell,
well.
One of my
yeah,
favorite
I mean,
guys.
Get, I mean, there's plenty of people that need jobs in Santa Cruz. You know, these people have failed. You know, there should be a price for failure. They should lose their jobs and give those jobs to other people, or hell, get the anarchists to do
well,
it.
You'll
I mean,
be
they,
glad
they
to hear that once a year the city manager gets a behind closed doors public analysis.
I thought you were going to say bonus.
that too, perhaps.
A bonus for doing nothing.
In any case, yeah, you're quite right. The city manager, not the city council, is the real power in
Santa
Cruz.
Because the city council has changed. And we still have the same problems because they don't really have all that much power. The city manager has a lot of power.
Let's hear some more from that equally powerful figure, the city attorney, John Barisoni.
The problem has been exacerbated. What we did in response to that as a city in early 2009, we adopted an ordinance that, to my understanding, is unique to the city of Santa Cruz. I'm not aware of any other cities that have an ordinance like this. What we said was that if an individual fails to appear on a municipal court infraction three times within a period of 6 months, that in and of itself constitutes a crime that rises to the level of misdemeanor. And the reason we made it a misdemeanor was that the court was still issuing arrest warrants for misdemeanors. So this gave us a tool with our most egregious offenders to get them into the court system and get them in front of a judge.
I've got some thoughts on this ordinance and a second ordinance that, of course, the city council also passed. This ordinance, which essentially makes three unattended infractions where you fail to appear in court, itself a misdemeanor. My first thought is you're actually going to hear some stats from John Barisoni on how many people have been taken down under this. There's a second ordinance, which I don't know that he goes into, which states that every subsequent infraction in the next 6 months becomes itself, in and of itself, a misdemeanor, punishable by time in jail and $1,000 fine.
They got to give you lawyers then.
They do have to give you lawyers, but what they then do is, short of trial, they reduce it to an infraction. So they can get the thrill of jailing you, the power to jail you, but without giving you the protection of a public defender.
See, now there's, like he said, we're the only city that have this. This is easily overturned. Then anytime you go to jail, you have definite federal rights. And that one of them is an attorney. If you don't have any money, they have to give you an attorney if they're going to put you in jail.
Only holding you until the...
Although holding you to trial, yeah. They can do that.
Although I don't think they can hold you to trial in a misdemeanor, but they did this, I know, in 1996 to one of the activists who started the 8-month-long City Hall Sleepers Vigil, Sean Alini. He insisted on sleeping out a second night, saying, arrest me under the misdemeanor provisions of the camping ordinance.
Mm-hmm.
That's no longer the case. You cannot be arrested as a misdemeanor under the camping ordinance at least on its face.
There's always lodging, though, the state law of lodging. They can always use it.
But they didn't
use it. They don't use it because they don't want to give you an attorney because attorneys cost
money. He was arrested for a misdemeanor, camping, but they dropped charges down to an infraction after they'd held him for weeks and weeks in jail. So it's
challengeable, but then again, who's going
to
do it?
Perhaps John Barisoni is calling in to challenge what we're doing. I never can tell. John may be listening. He's never called my show before. But. Hey, you're on Free Radio with Valerie Free and, of course, me.
Okay, Valerie Free. I didn't know who that was. Thank you for clarifying that.
It's supposed to be David.
Hi, Uncle Robert.
David Silva, you left your shirt at the Huff meeting.
Okay. You know, I just disrobe just about anywhere nowadays, you know.
Here. Do it downtown.
I just wanted to say that I've heard two really, very, real strong things tonight, important things. I think, one, you know, to not let these bums stay in office any longer, I think is really important. That's a little harder to do, and we need to build a campaign. And to build a campaign, I think we need to have everybody get those tickets and refuse to sign them.
Well, of course, we tried the flood the jails approach, or actually it was flood the courts approach, back in the late 80s. And, you know, it is still a possibility, except that, you know, people are often, they think they're willing to do it, but then even, we see it with the Occupy people, we saw it with the Peace Camp people, they didn't really want to go to jail on these issues. And Free, you yourself have
I don't believe in going to jail,
and
especially
you,
around
you
here.
I've
had five deaths. You get in, then they can kill you, and no one knows, you know?
Uncle Robert, if you can get me some kind of speaking engagement for some kind of college group, I can convince them that instead of sleeping in the cars and getting tickets, they ought to just refuse to sign.
Okay, well, as you know, I have great power up at the University of California. I'm a well-known provost. But thank you for your thought, David, and don't forget to pick up your shirt. Otherwise, you may lose your shirt.
I just don't know what to do. Okay, I will. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye. More from John Barisoni, and hopefully we'll actually get back past the point we were at in the last show, because we still haven't reached that yet. So for those of you who are waiting, here he comes.
The way that system works, I explained how the citation system works. It's very streamlined. The officer issues a citation. The person signs the citation and appears in court in his or her own accord. With the misdemeanor process that the city has implemented in response to the court's change in its approach to infraction enforcement, we have to monitor the court records for the failures to appear. And the court has been very cooperative in helping us do that. They send us printouts every month of the individuals who have failed to appear three times within 6 months. The report is sent to the police department and to our office, and the police department then refers cases to our office. We have to file a criminal complaint, which takes the place of a citation. Once the complaint has been prepared, a Santa Cruz police officer walks the complaint through the court system in order to obtain an arrest warrant from the judge. And once we have an arrest warrant on the misdemeanor municipal code charge, the next time any police officer in the department has contact with the defendant can be taken into custody and held until he or she is arraigned. And sometimes the court will actually release the person on their own recognizance. But our hope is that they are held until they're arraigned, so they at least get two or three nights in jail and then face the judge in court. Oh, these people are being arrested in the first place because they failed to appear. They're released after they're arrested on a misdemeanor. There's a good life.
The question for me is, how many middle-class people are actually being impacted by this? Isn't this clearly a law designed to punish and criminalize homeless people who are being faced with these impossible infractions that it's either humiliating to respond to or impossible in terms of your life situation to respond to? And I think that is something that could be covered for all of you listeners out there. If you want to do a help work with the Public Records Act Request Bureau subsection of the Huff machine, Maine. We have a very powerful organization, well known throughout the country.
You should do a, you know, a monthly how to do a record request.
Not very hard. You just write an email to the agency and say this is a Public Records Act request. You don't have to do much more than that.
Well, you could send them a sample to anybody that wanted to do it to just send you
right,
an email.
Right, but I mean that's really all you need to do. I'd like to know all the records. Send me all the records regarding this particular situation between the dates of blah blah and blah blah.
Yeah.
But in any case, we need to know. I mean, are these laws that are supposedly they're billed as, oh, this guy didn't pay his fines and he's trying to get away with it, instead of, oh, these are ridiculous citations that were issued and now they're going after people who haven't got any money to try to, essentially, it was to drive them out of town and it isn't working because they have stronger
they
ties.
They don't have any money to leave, too.
You know, and they don't have any money to leave either. How many people are with 115 Coral Street and transient addresses are getting these citations? No doubt that will be used by the Task Force on Public Safety to show how many criminals there are and how big a crime problem.
Well, they won't give you the address of the person arrested.
Well, they can. You can find out how many are listed, I believe, as transient or 115 Coral Street. I think you can, particularly if the cases are old. I mean, if they're, but I'm not sure.
If they're.
In any case, if I think we need to know to expose the fact that this is not a law that's actually designed to deal with a staggering court system where real miscreants are failing to pay legitimate fines.
We know that 65% of the police force spends their time on these homeless crimes, and when you hear the crimes, the majority of them are not crimes if you do them inside a house.
65% comes from what, Deputy Chief Clark?
They admitted it recently. To show how bad the homeless are, but like I said, you just look underneath the facts a little bit, and they're the silly little crimes you're talking about that aren't crimes for middle class people in houses, and so that means if we got rid of all these laws, we could fire over half our police force and save a whole lot of money,
or direct them to crimes like rape and violence.
You see people getting shot and nothing being done about it while they're writing a ticket for somebody sitting on a sidewalk. You know,
well, smoking is a serious crime.
Then they'll fail to appear again. It's a lot more labor intensive, and since the ordinance was adopted in 2009, our office has prosecuted 29 cases, 10 are still pending, so we've prosecuted 19 through judgment or resolution, and typically the manner in which they're resolved is that a public defender is appointed. Because these are misdemeanors, if you're indigent, you are entitled to a public defender. So the individual will be arrested typically on a Thursday or Friday. They're incarcerated until their arraignment on Monday or Tuesday, so they will have done 3 or 4 days of jail time by the time they're arraigned.
Notice the kind of nasty edge. We're going to punish them before trial for their failure to appear. Barisoni has twice mentioned this. Again, kind of pandering to a group of people who are really looking for blood. That's what I'm wondering. I mean, again, I have a bias. I don't like the makeup of this task force. I don't like their agenda. I don't think they're really considering real crimes of violence. So I believe their next task force meeting this coming Wednesday is supposed to consider crimes of violence. Can you imagine public safety considering crimes of violence? What a concept. But most of what they've been doing has not been that. And what Barisoni...
They say nothing about that surfing child molester either, you know, that was a member of their group.
I don't see them
complaining about child molesters. It's just somebody.
You're referring
poor.
To the surf school guy who was not on the task force.
But he was a part of Take Back Santa Cruz, and a lot of those people are on the task force, I'm sure.
At least one Take Back Santa Cruz person, John Golder's daughter, I believe, is on the task force. You can't choose your offspring, I guess.
I was going to say.
Yeah. Right, let's hear a little more because we're running short of time. I was going to play today some interviews from the street, which were kindly brought to me into the studio. And also, I was going to play some of the actual narrative of the city council at meeting at which the two most recent anti-homeless laws were passed last Tuesday. But it looks like I'm running out of time. We're running against the clock. It's almost 8 o'clock. And so I'll have to do that on Sunday at 9:30. I want to remind you that there is a protest being planned for a week from Sunday in front of Forever 21. We will be having an organizational meeting to plan that for food, that for entertainment, for speakers, for singers, for dancers. Who knows? We have everything. For the national media hookup we're going to be having in front of, we're having that, the planning session will be on Saturday, day after tomorrow.
The Occupy meeting?
Right before the Occupy meeting at the main post office in Santa Cruz, right
so
after the
time?
Food Not Bombs meal at 5 o'clock in the afternoon.
5 o'clock, and then Occupy starts at 5:30.
And then Occupy will start at 5:30 or whenever Occupy
decides. Occupy is mostly Huff these days anyway.
Yeah, Occupy and Huff seem to merge together as we move along. So I'm going to play some more of Barisoni. I'll try to let him speak his piece because it's really important that people be able to hear the kind of toxic trash that is passing for wisdom these days.
That man has caused more suffering than any other single person in this city.
He certainly has created laws that have done that. I've got to say that. And he's
responsible
them.
For it, really.
And it's true. He's been there longer than Martine Bernal, the current city manager. He's been there longer than any of the heads of state, like heads of departments like Danette Shoemaker, the Tsarina of Parks and Rec.
And he advises them how to do it.
He does advise them how to do it. He's been in there longer than the police chief, Kevin Vogel. So let's hear more of the man that you may love to hate, although, you know, he's a mild-mannered character. He's not. He's become increasingly recalcitrant in his emails or lack of emails to me. But, you know, it's this whole system, of course, that creates a city attorney that is likely to pander to these forces. So
it's his job.
It is his job.
And at that time, the judge typically asked the public defender and city attorney to negotiate a reasonable resolution of the matter, and typically we'll get a few more days of jail time. There will be a sentence of, you know, anywhere from 30 to 60 days. The sentence will be suspended with credit for time served for the days served. The defendant, during a suspended sentence, is on probation. She is commanded to obey all laws, or in many instances where the person has caused a problem repeatedly, a certain geographical area like downtown or near the wharf or on Beach Street will get a stay-away order where during the term of probation the person can't be in that particular location. And if they violate the order, then they have to serve their remaining sentence, which is typically another 30 to 60 days. But it's a lot, as I said, it's a lot more labor intensive, and we really, in the 3 years that we've been doing it, we've basically had 29 referrals from the police department. So the police department, because they have to devote so much resources to this, they only send us the most egregious cases. We, just by coincidence, this morning, I received a printout from the court's office of all the failures to appear. And what I just did, sort of give your committee a sense of what we're dealing with in terms of magnitude of the problem. In 2013 alone, so in the first 8 months of this year through August 31st, we have 113 individuals in Santa Cruz who are eligible for prosecution under the failure to appear ordinance because they committed three or more infractions within a six-month period for which they failed to appear. Those 113 individuals are responsible for 597 unadjudicated citations. And open container, conduct on public property, soliciting at a bus stop, sleeping outdoors with or without bedding, garbage on streets, dog collar tag, proper license, all types of different things. Dogs on Pacific Avenue after dark.
And I want, let's look at that list of crimes, which the police department, which Barisoni is wasting our time on, his office's time on, the police department's time on, the court's time on, the citizens' time on. As you pointed out, Free, is everything that is, in fact, legal indoors. But look at the actual crimes. Open container, that is drinking a beer. not getting drunk, not being abusive or raucous. That's just having an open container. Conduct of public property, that sounds ominous. That means sitting down where you're not supposed to sit. It means sitting on one of these public statues that's perfectly fine, pushing the pendulum in front of the Betty's hamburger joint. It can mean sitting on the low-lying lip of one of the planters around a tree on downtown Pacific Avenue. That's conduct on public property. Soliciting at a bus stop. Oh, it sounds like prostitution. No, it means asking for money of any kind. Or having a sign that requests money for any kind at a bus stop. Sleeping outdoors without bedding. Wow. That must be pretty cold. But it's illegal to do it with and without bedding at night. What do you do at home? Do you sleep at home? Garbage on the street. Well, you know, I mean, there are garbage containers downtown. A few. I mean, there are some. But it's also true, for example, that if you try and find a Sharps container for needles, you can have a hard time. I talked to a Parks and Rec guy 2 days ago who was dealing with levee problems in his Parks and Rec van. He told me they don't have Sharps containers down on the levee at all, even though that's the place where you might think that needle problems might be the most intensive, because that's where homeless people are. Well, I don't know. Needle problems would be most intense probably indoors. There's a greater number, I would imagine, of needle users indoors than outdoors, for sure, because there's a much huger population of people. Even though there may be a greater percentage of drug abusers in the homeless population, though that's not been shown, there's a greater number, much greater number of people who are indoors. But still, there are no containers. There are no garbage containers. So these are excuses and pretexts and demonization pictures, scare pictures of homeless people that are designed to frighten the community. They provide political capital for people who use this as an engine to reach political power. They provide funding sources for those who are in the police department or even in the poverty industry, the poverty pimp industry, because they can say, see, we're trying to deal with these problems by giving them a bed bug ridden places to sleep for one night after they wait for 2 months on the waiting list. You know, and these serve the interests of different groups, but they don't serve the interest of dealing with the problem of jobs and housing, which is really what people in this society and the social organization we have today, and I'm not putting out a lot of rah-rahs for that, need. You need a place to go, and you need a job to earn an income in order to pay for the damn place to go. Here's a little more from Barisoni, but before we do, any last comments, Free, that you want to make before we almost close up the show? Okay.
Dogs on the beach, all types of different items. There are individuals here. We have one individual that we've actually filed a complaint on. In 2013 alone, he's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16.